net tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
And this is that net that's being talked about. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and at this time, as we've done for the last 34 years, we've run the TechNet every Sunday night. It's one of the longest running nets as far as total number of hours and total number of years of service under essentially one leadership. It's a gathering of people who have got curiosity about radio in general, ham radio operators who want to know a little bit more about how the equipment works, how to make it work better, how to understand some of its crazy idiosyncrasies. We had a considerable discussion on antennas last week, and I made a pretty big error. I guess it was Christopher, KD2KZG, who I think was complimenting us for discussing antennas, and I misunderstood. Quite often when we get into antennas, we get a little bit deep on the subject, and some people come along and say, hey, you're spending too much time on that subject. Once in a while, I think we've got to spend time. And I was responding, I was misresponding that way, so I owe Christopher an apology for falsely accusing. Let me drop it. I received in the last week or two a very nice letter from Steve, KD2HUC. You remember a couple of weeks ago he had bought a Armatron AL80A kilowatt amplifier on eBay and it was not working. And by way of all of the help that you guys gave him, he was able to troubleshoot it, take apart, fix the problem. He's now putting out a full kilowatt. He's very happy about that. Also received a nice letter from John, KC2SHO. He's the guy who was telling us about the kind of an antenna you can put underneath the automobile, attach it to sort of a V-beam dipole-like thing that you can attach to the frame of the car, underneath the car. And he shipped me an article showing how that can be done. At first you would think, gee, an antenna, it's under the metal, under the frame of the car, would have to work terrible. Poor in performance. In reality, if you look at it backwards, make believe you were building a dipole-like antenna and you wanted to shield the signal to make sure it didn't radiate. That's nowhere near enough shielding, if you know what I mean. So it's going to radiate. Not the best antenna in the world, but that's a good way of having a hidden antenna on a car. And so he showed me an article on that one from, as I said, KC2SHO, John. The TechNet, the last 10 years of TechNet are recorded. Play them back at amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Let me drop. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and even this TechNet that you're listening to tonight, in theory, in a few days, you'll be able to go there and hear the recording of this one if you're not able to stay up that late. And there's another website, that first website, KC2NJI, runs it, Mike number two, K1MZ, MJM, runs the other website that supports the TechNet, and that's at limarktechnet.com. And there you'll find pictures, articles, and whatever, and graphs that support the TechNet. We've got a very loose schedule that we follow, and that is during the first hour we take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. They check in, give me their call letters, their name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. You don't have to check in if you're listening. After 34 years, we have reason to believe somebody is listening. That's followed by the mailbag, KC2WTB. John runs that, and he collects letters and emails and whatever from people who don't yet have the right equipment to talk to us directly or don't have the right license yet. And they submit questions, and John has gotten as many as 78 of those questions in a one-week period of time. And John selects one, two, three, or four of those that are of general interest, and we discuss them. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, with the space report. And over the last week, there was a Soviet Progress ship that's supposed to bring up cargo that didn't make it. It had a rocket engine failure. So Paul will most likely be giving us information about that. So those are the main guys of the TechNet, K2RAW, KC2WGB, and Paul WS2N. And from time to time we hear from Al, K6DBZ, who gives us what he calls the brief reports, the quickies, and occasionally he and I have a slight difference of opinion, and you hear both sides of the story. You can decide which one applies to you, if you know what I mean. Last week there was a difference of opinion between Hal and I, and we'll probably will go back to that that particular subject tonight again. And that was the one that was a question from Joe to B2RYY. He wanted to know why, when you transmit to an antenna that has a standing wave ratio, it's an improperly tuned antenna, which means a certain amount of the power you send to the antenna gets reflected back to you. That's what standing wave ratio measures, percentage of reflected power. Let me drop it. So when you're transmitting and some of the signal is not accepted by the antenna and it's sent back toward the transmitter, and with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, you get a half a dB of loss from that phenomenon. Joe understood that. But because of the law of reciprocity, whatever gain or pattern or whatever you lose or gain, all the characteristics of an antenna in the transmit mode are identical to the receive mode. And Joe was asking the question, okay, in the receive mode, you're still going to lose half a dB. So power is not being reflected back to the transmitter. Transmitter is not even evolved. Where does that go? And so we're going to go back and revisit that a little bit later, because there's more to that story. Where does that extra power go, and how did it get there? At this time, we're going to take check-ins. For people who do have a question or comment, you're about to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. And I should mention the fact that last week we didn't get to John, KD2IXP. So if he's there tonight, he goes number one on the runway. And I think that everyone else last week we did cover. So give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
K2RIY, Joe, yes.
I think Wes had a question also.
Okay. Joe, Wes, and just before Joe talked, there was another person checking in. Who was that?
It's WB2GXM.
Okay, WB2GXM. And you probably told me your name, but you said it fast in the beginning and I didn't catch it. Mr. GXM, please tell me your handle, sir. K2RAW.
It was Rich.
Okay. Rich, each time you talk to us, you got to squeeze the mic, wait a second, and then talk. We're always missing the beginning of your conversation. So we've got Joe, Wes, and Rich checked in so far. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RAW.
KV2KNL. The name is Ed. Good evening.
Okay, Ed, and you do have a question or a comment. Is that true, Ed?
Yes.
Well done. You're on the list. And one last call. Anyone to check into the TechNet, because you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay. Joe, you asked an extremely provocative question last week. Before I get your question of this week, I'm going to go back and give you a little bit of a different picture than we gave you last week. That antenna, if you built it out of low-loss materials, has very little insertion loss. It's a little bit like an ideal transformer with a certain number of turns in the primary and secondary. So if you had a 3-to-1 turns ratio, an ideal transformer inside of a black box, to some degree, you could say an antenna acts like that black box. It's got two connectors. The connector on the right side is labeled 50 ohms. The connector on the left side of the box is labeled 377 ohms. So in the ideal world, your 50 ohm transmitter talks to a 50 ohm transmission line, goes into the black box, which is the antenna, gets a 3-to-1 turns ratio, voltage step up, 6-to-1 impedance step up almost. And so it matches free space, 377 ohms. That's the left-hand side of the black box. I call it a connector. And to some degree, the free space acts a little bit like a transmission line. It's got some of those same characteristics. It's got standing wave ratio. So when you're receiving, if, for instance, I took a perfectly matched antenna, and on the right-hand side, which is supposed to be terminated with 50 ohms, I terminate it with 25 ohms, a pair of 50-ohm resistors, 50-ohm terminations in parallel on a T-connector. So I put 25 ohms on the right side. I've created a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And so now the 377 ohms on the left side, because of this ideal transformer action of the antenna, is going to become 189 ohms. So when this free space signal in free space at 377 ohms hits the 189 ohm connector, so to speak, on the left-hand side of this box, there's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and the signal gets reflected back into space. Ain't that...
Repeater, timeout.
So because the antenna has the exact same characteristics on transmit and receive, naively, you and I would assume that, hey, wherever the loss takes place, it's the exact same place on transmit and receive, and it's not. The loss occurs because of what's going on inside the black box, so to speak. But the signal that's not collected from space that could have been collected because of a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio in the antenna gets reflected back into space. You get the exact same loss, but the power goes in a different place. And I've done that experiment using an instrumentation radar aimed at an antenna as a target. And by changing the termination on the antenna, I could see the change in the reflection of the antenna when I was transmitting a signal to it. That's what a radar measures, the reflection of a signal that hits an object. So you asked a darn good question that kept us going for a good fraction of an hour last week, Joe. Go easy with us this week. W2RYY with your next question. K2RYW on the TechNet.
Wasn't there a guy ahead of me from Lexington who didn't check in, had a problem checking in, or was absent when you asked where he was? Wasn't somebody ahead of me?
Yes, that was John, KD2IXP, and we haven't heard from him yet this week. When he comes back, he goes to the head of the list. And so when we finally got to him, he wasn't there. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, well, this is a continuation of what was asked last week, and I did some measurements, some experimentation on the, like, I guess we could call it like a far field type of measurement. This is all on 52525. I'm doing these measurements. I'm using an FM receiver, not an AM or sideband. So it makes it a little easier to determine signal strength that way by just listening to the quieting or when it hits a quieting point. I use a transmitter I have on 6 meters, my TS690, and the power of that radio can be adjustable to like basically nothing. We couldn't even measure it out. And I think when the power is turned all the way down, it puts out something like about 10 milliwatts out of the antenna jack, which for my measurements is fine. You got that so far?
I've got that so far.
Okay, I fed that into a disc cone antenna, which is reasonably resonant on 6 meters. Not maybe not completely, but it works well enough for what we're talking about here. It works okay because I've used it before in other frequencies, 2 meters and 6 meters, so forth. It works pretty much broadband, so it doesn't have too much reflective power, and it radiates a signal, which is the important thing. I went about a half a mile away from my house to a clearing, a nice area where there's like a clearing, a very wide open area, like about a half mile by half mile, not too many trees and houses, things like that. So I read them and all those things. I knew I wouldn't get too much of a reflection or things moving around me. And I went to a place where I got the signal, probably parked partially in the null or whatever, but the signal was about 20 dB quieting on 6 meters. Okay? You got that so far.
So 10 milliwatts into a disc cone antenna, half a mile away, gave you approximately 20 dB of noise quieting. Sounds reasonable so far.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Sounds reasonable so far, Joe. Back to you.
Okay, staying stationary and not moving the car anymore, I now took the 6-meter antenna off the mag mount I have on the roof and put a 10-meter antenna in place of it. And it's hard to measure the signal strength, but it was noticeably noisier. Okay? And then I put my other antenna, which I usually use because of its shorter length for receive purposes, not transmitting purposes, which is a 2-meter quarter wave spike, which is the same kind of Motorola NMO type of mount. And that hurt a little less than the 6-meter antenna, but it was actually better than the 10-meter antenna, okay? So you got that, then I'll give you some measurements, because I duplicated the same type of situation at my house with a signal generator. I'll get to that momentarily.
Okay, so the strongest signal was received on the 6-meter antenna, The next strongest was the 6-meter spike, and the weakest was on the 10-meter antenna. That's what I think you've said, Doug. Go ahead.
The 6-meter antenna is a loaded antenna. It's not a full quarter wave. It's a loaded antenna. The next strongest signal was a 2-meter quarter wave spike, 144 to 150 range. But the worst one was my 10-meter antenna, which was around 29.6. That was worse. Now, when I got back to my house, I was able to actually take my signal generator, set it up on the car, and feed another antenna I have on the car. But instead of feeding an antenna, I have an adapter on those that fits an NMO that lets you put a dummy load. It's a way of testing the NMO mount. It's a fitting that allows you to screw it onto the NMO mount. The end of it's terminated with the SO239 termination. So I fit it onto that. UHF to UHF to UHF T connector with the male end open. So it's got females on both ends, and on the top they put a 50 ohm terminator. So the alarm is effectively terminated at 50 ohms, but had a little bit of leakage allowed because of this connector and so forth. So that gave me a simulated, I don't know if you call it an isotropic antenna, but something that starts approaching that. Okay, got that so far.
Yeah, that thing strikes me a little bit like that bug-like device that people use for injecting a signal and measuring sensitivity of a repeater in the transmit mode. Back to you, Joe, and wait for the beeps.
Okay. So, now I put a signal in from the signal generator, which happened to be around, I think I had to turn up the dial to about -34 dBm. And that gave me a signal strength of about 20 dB according into the 6-meter loaded antenna. And once I had the signal generator adjusted to achieve that level, I left that alone. So I went up to the up on the roof and changed the antenna to a 10-meter antenna, and the signal got noticeably weaker, almost the same thing as what I noticed in the far field. I had to increase the signal generator from -34 to -25 to get the same 20 dB quantity. So there's a differential there of about 9 dB. I did the same test with the 2-meter spike, and that was not as good as the 6-meter antenna, but it was better than 10 meters, just like in the far field. I only had to turn up the generator from -34 to about -28 dB, dBm. Got that so far?
Yes, I do, Joe. Wait for the beeps when it comes back to you.
Yeah, I don't know what that other transmission is. It's not me. Okay, so now knowing this, I got some funny performance measurements. I increased the signal level out of the generator where I can actually use it in the duplex mode and actually look at my signal being returned on the 6-meter antenna in the spectrum analyzer. And I seem to measure a differential of about 70-something dB. And when I did the calculations, the 6-meter sensitivity of the receiver would make that to be around -104. And that's pretty much what I concluded by using this RF tap previously, making a similar kind of measurement, because I have apparently a high noise floor on 6 meters, which is about 14 dB over, worse than the receiver sensitivity, and it's pretty much proved almost the same thing. So you got that so far.
Yes, I do, and -104, if that was a barefoot receiver, not connected to a antenna in a noisy environment, -104, let's see now, 107 dB is a microvolt, 104 is probably 1.5 microvolts. If you are doing that receiver test with a signal generator straight into a receiver, that would indicate a fairly dead receiver. But in your case, you know you've got a lot of excess local noise. Thank you, Joe. Wait for the beeps.
I am waiting for the beeps. Okay. Now I measured the return loss, because the other measurements I've been doing with the analyzer didn't seem to make a lot of sense. I could see a signal from my generator being generated myself. I could see that if I turn the generator up. Had to turn the generator up to about -10 to be able to bring the spike up out of the noise where the generator could actually see it. The inspector could see it properly. I'll get to that in a moment. But that was the interesting part of it, was I measured the return loss using a return loss bridge of three test antennas, actually four test antennas I had. I used a 10-meter antenna, 2-meter, 6-meter, and actually a 70-centimeter antenna, because that gave me very similar performance to the 2-meter spike. It was a little worse, but it was better than the 10-meter antenna. But the 6-meter antenna had a measured return loss on the mag mount of minus 18. The 2-meter antenna gave me a return loss of minus 2. The 10-meter antenna gave me a return loss of minus 2. And the 70-centimeter antenna gave me a return loss of minus 2. All at 52.525, just simply changing the antenna on the mount. Got that so far?
Yeah, those are crazy sounding numbers. Each of those antennas are, except for the one on 2 meters, is being fed on the wrong frequency. Oh, wait a minute. You did say a minus 2. Minus 2 is a big reflection coefficient. That's a pretty high standing wave ratio. Now it makes sense. Got it so far. Go ahead.
Okay. The funny thing I noticed is also the 6-meter being fairly resonant. It's actually resonant to around 51.5, 51.8. It was about like minus 25, 28, something like that. But it was minus 18 on 52.525. I purposely cut it that way so I'd have... I could use repeater inputs okay and not have too much return loss down that part of the band either, so that's okay. But I would think with the other antennas being showing this almost the same return loss on all three other antennas that were way out of band, they don't show me the same performance difference as a receiving antenna as I showed in my field tests, either far field or near field. How would you explain that? They all show the same return loss, but they all show a different performance type of ratio when compared to 6-meter antenna, which is resonant.
Now, repeat the question. Are you asking why are they different on signal strength? Why are they different on VISWA? I'm not quite sure what the question was, Joe, so repeat the question. Go ahead.
Question is, with these other different antennas being used as receiving antennas on 52.525, like a 10-meter antenna, loaded antenna, a 2-meter quarter-wave spike, and a UHF quarter-wave spike, they all show the same return loss, but they show different performance as far as them being a receiving antenna. Why do I show a difference like this? I would expect that if the, to almost exhibit a similar receiving sensitivity as far as being like receiving a signal on that frequency, but they don't give you the same performance as far as the receiver was concerned, but they all show the same return loss. Why is that?
As I see it, Joe, you've got three variables involved. When you measure return loss, you're measuring the amount of signal not accepted by the antenna when you're transmitting. And it's also probably the same ratio of what's not accepted in the receive mode. So the reflection coefficient of the antenna is telling you one of the loss mechanisms of the antenna, the VISWA loss component. Another component is these three different antennas have three different amounts of gain in the desired direction, three different antenna patterns. That's a second variable. In your particular environment, a third variable is you've got a hell of a lot of noise on 6 meters. A good 6-meter antenna is going to be picking up the signal the way you want it to, but it's going to be picking up a lot of local noise. So on top of that, a fourth variable involved is that if you had a good low noise front end on that receiver, because these antennas have different amounts of standing wave ratio on different reflection coefficients, even though antenna number one and antenna number two might both have a minus 2 dB reflection coefficient. One of them minus 2 dB might be that amount of reflected power, but it might be because of a high VISWA, and the other one might be a high impedance, and the other one might be a low impedance. So therefore, the phase angle of what's being reflected is different, and your low noise amplifier has an entirely different noise figure depending on what standing wave ratio and what phase angle it's looking into. Let me drop. In theory, your low noise amplifier, if you were using one, is tuned up to give best performance in the center of that Smith chart. and you could, in theory, on this discharge, draw a whole bunch of contour lines as to what noise figure you get, depending on where your impedance falls, where that dot falls on the Smith chart. You get various amounts of noise figure. So you're looking for a simple answer as a function of reflective power showing you performance. In reality, you've got four variables involved and a weird mixture of those four variables. You've done an interesting experiment. Interpreting the results is not going to be easy. So you don't have a standard gain. You don't have a standard VISWAR. Your VISWAR may be the same magnitude, but it may not be the same VISWAR. There's an infinite number of ways I can give you a 2 dB reflection coefficient. I can draw a particular diameter circle on the Smith chart. Anywhere on that circle, you would get a 2 dB reflection coefficient. But those are very different impedances, creating very different characteristics to your LNA. So I ain't got a nice simple answer on this one, Joe. You don't have a simple experiment. You've got a fairly complicated experiment. Mother Nature can always throw in a couple of more monkey wrenches, if you know what I mean. If you think it's simple, you don't understand the problem when you're dealing with Mother Nature. Over to you, Joe. K2IW.
Okay. Well, here's the other funny thing that I noticed the last thing. We used the spectrum analyzer, especially on 52.5-5. With the antenna up to 6 meters, and I have this generator set at 52.525, and I'm using the duplex output instead of the TR output. The instrument's capable of doing either one. Duplex means you can use a spectrum analyzer at the same time as a duplex port. You can transmit at the same time at the same frequency, or a split frequency if you desire. So I took that signal level, I had to raise it up higher, because the minus 34 unit spectrum analyzer was like about minus 100. It was in the noise, pretty much. So I had to bring it up higher to actually give me a usable trace on the analyzer. Bringing it up to about a minus 10 or so, the signal on the analyzer went up to about minus 80 on the set frequency. Now, what it did then was move the frequency up 2 megahertz, which is going further away from my, where the antenna is 206 meters, and the actual level became higher. And it wasn't leakage from my cables, because when I took the 6-meter antenna off, the spike pretty much went away to one of my dens of noise. So I was receiving something being introduced directly through that antenna, but when I changed frequency, the intensity of that spike went up about at least 4 or 5 or so, with 6 dB higher, by going up 2 megahertz higher in frequency.
Between the antenna during the transmitting and the antenna during receiving was roughly how much difference, Joe? Go ahead. What distance are we talking about?
Well, it's only transmitting the signal generator. That's all it's doing, really. I'm still transmitting. I wasn't transmitting into that antenna as it transmits. I'm still using the other antenna, the other mount with the dummy load and the T connector on it. That's what I was always using that as a signal source. And I tried to do that where I figured it would probably give me a more constant impedance over a wide frequency range if I changed frequencies, instead of having using an antenna that would be changing according to another variable to be looked into consideration. So figuring that gave me almost a fairly constant impedance, especially going across a couple of megs either way from my test frequency. When I did that, I saw from the 6-meter antenna being used as a receiving antenna, and it was connected to the spectrum analyzer input, that went up about 6 dB higher, maybe even 7, when it went 2 megahertz higher in frequency, 54, I think like 54.525, it went up actually higher. As it went higher in frequency, it started dropping back down and going lower, progressively much, much lower. It went up to like 60 to 70 megahertz. Back to you.
Okay, once again, you're moving a signal generator by 2 or more megacycles. You're watching the response change by a good number of dB. What was in between that signal generator and the thing that's measuring the response? Is it a cable going into an NMO connector, which is going into a spectrum analyzer? I don't have the picture of where the source of signal was, what kind of hardware it's going through, and where it's being received, so that when you change by a couple of megs, the signal gets stronger. There's something in between there that I don't have the picture of it yet, Joe. Over to you, K2IW.
Okay. The sending device is you was either the TR port or the duplex port of the generator. The duplex port, like I said, lets me transmit and receive at the same time, either through the receiver or the spectrumizer. That's what the instrument is capable of doing. The receiving port of the analyzer, spectrum, the antenna input, that's where the cable, I put the cable from that I was normally using on my 6-meter FM radio. I took it off the 6-meter FM radio, put it onto the spectrum analyzer input, and we're keeping the dial the same at minus 34, which gave me 20 dB of quieting, which I calculated that to be about minus 104. I could barely see that into the noise of the analyzers, the analyzer's noise floor. So I had to increase the generator level quite a bit to bring that up and look at my path loss in a loop between one sending antenna and one receiving antenna, and that looked like about 70 dB of space in signal level, about 70 dB of loss between one point to another on the car, and they're about about 1 meter apart. That's what the receiving was, and I had to move that level up higher to about minus 10 to be able to see a comfortable level on the analyzer of about minus 80 where I could view it. Once I did that, I changed the frequency, and the level went up to like minus 73 or 74.
Wait to CDL. Can I ask Joe a question?
Joe, you believe that duplexing port is completely flat as a function of frequency? When it goes back to you, I'm going to ask you that question. Andy, go over to you. Go ahead, Andy.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask Joe. Joe, I think I know what you're using because I have the same unit, and mine is not flat. There were bumps in it, and I checked that. So I just wanted to mention that to you, that mine is not flat. If you're using the same one that I have.
You got it, Joe. Wait till the beeps.
Yeah, I'm using an IFR 1500, just like probably one of 10 that you happen to own. I know they're not flat. If you go across the higher, a very wide range of frequencies, maybe from 1 to 1,000, you may not see the thing exactly flat, maybe the same. It won't be the same as the TR port, but it's not that far off as far as the level outputs in the duplex jack compared to the TR jack, and it doesn't change that much, only going 2 or 3 megahertz of frequency. I have checked that out with a power sampling unit that's capable of reading power sampling, a power sampling unit like open and rich. So I checked that already, and it doesn't change that much, really. Not in a couple of megs away.
Over to you, Andy. Any other suggestions, Andy?
No. The only thing that I noticed on mine is that the input impedance, and this is kind of interesting, the input impedance of the attenuator actually changed with different attenuator settings. It's supposed to be 50 ohms, but I had a defective attenuator, which actually changed its impedance as I was moving the attenuator dial. It's supposed to not change at all. It's supposed to be the same, but it was not.
Roughly, what did it change from, and what did it change to? Andy, go ahead.
I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. This was a while back, but I have it written down on my notes. I don't have the numbers, that I could just ramble off to you right now.
Yeah, from what you've described, Joe, I don't think we're going to be able to give you an answer tonight. We're going to think about it some more. With only, I think you said, 1 meter of difference between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna, it's very hard for me to call that multipath. However, even with only 1 meter of spacing between the two antennas, if I have heard you correctly on that one, still, that signal could be going to some other object in the room, reflecting from that object, and some of the signal going to the receiving antenna. And as you swish in frequency, those the reflected signal versus the direct signal can be going from in phase to out of phase. But for only 2 megs of motion, I'll admit that it's very hard to explain that one because you don't have enough wavelengths involved, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Joe, K2IW.
Okay, by the way, this test was done outside on my automobile, which is a station wagon type of vehicle. So I wasn't inside, I was outside. I was parked away from my garage, so I wouldn't have the metal door acting as a reflector. It was about almost 20 feet away from the garage door, at the end of my driveway, and there were no overhead wires directly, you know, directly overhead either.
Yeah, but you're also getting a lot of reflections off the sheet metal of the automobile. We'll admit that 2 megs, it's hard to, the number of wavelengths have changed of only 2 megs. It's hard to explain that one. I don't think we got an explanation. I think you got a bit of a mystery there, Joe. Go ahead.
Well, it gives you something more to talk about. So this is all I have for this week, and maybe this could be continued some other week. You know, somebody comes up with some other ideas, whatever, maybe I'll... It's hard to do this. Like I said, I was talking with John one night. It's an interesting phenomenon, RF, because it's something you can't see. You have to use your instrumentation to measure it and make it you know, make sense to you that way. If you could see it, it'd be a whole other story, wouldn't it?
And you have to make believe you can see it and draw mental images of the signal coming out of the transmitting antenna. Every signal that you transmit is going to reflect off of everything in your environment. The front panel of the transmitter, the floor you're standing on, the walls that's near you, the wiring that's in the walls, the downspouts and the gutters of your rain collecting system and so on. You transmit a signal, it goes to everything in the environment. And so that receiving signal going to the receiving antenna, you and I would like to envision one simple path through air from the transmitting antenna to the receiving antenna. There's an infinite number of paths. Each one of those paths creates a different number of microvolts at the receiving antenna. And Mother Nature takes every one of those paths, the zillions of them, takes the voltage, not the power, the voltage of each one of those paths, and adds up all those voltages in a vector manner. In other words, adds up the voltage magnitude, including the phase angle. So, except for an anechoic chamber, we never have a pure signal going from the transmitting antenna to the receiving antenna. There's always an extremely large number of paths by which the signal is getting there simultaneously every time you set up a transmitter and a receiver on planet Earth. If you and your fellow astronaut are both floating a mile away from the space shuttle in space, there you got free space, or in an anechoic chamber, yes. But almost everywhere else, you're adding up a whole bunch of signals. And with minor changes in position, rotation of the antenna, move it in X, Y, and Z, rotate it, change the frequency, whatever, all of those zillions of voltages add up in some other manner. And therefore, you do a swept frequency response.
Repeater, timeout.
You do a swept frequency response between any transmitter and any receiver, and you'll get a very complicated bumpy curve because of all of those multipaths. And you'd be amazed how many people think that, okay, some of those objects in the environment, they're insulating objects, a 2x4, and the tops of the trees and whatever. You get a beautiful reflection off a 2x4. It's a few dB weaker than a chunk of steel of the same size, but you still get a reflection. That signal, when it's launched into air, wants to see nothing but 377 ohms of free space air impedance. That chunk of 2x4 has got a dielectric constant of about 3 to 1. The signal goes into the 2x4, propagates at a very different rate, and some of the signal reflects right off the first surface of the 2x4. You and I would sit there and say, hey, this is a perfectly dry, thoroughly aged 2x4. Uh-uh. It is a dielectric object that's going to give you a reflection. A piece of glass on the front window of a storefront. You think, hey, glass is transparent. You look at it at a grazing angle and you see a significant reflection. It has a different dielectric constant than the air around it. Any change in the impedance is going to give you a reflection. All you have to discuss is how much and at what phase angle. Let me drop. So as you can see, propagation is complicated. And to try to make a situation to simplify it, like an anechoic chamber, at microwave frequencies like 2 gigs and above, easy. You try to build a real good anechoic chamber at 154 megacycles, you'd be amazed how difficult that is to do. Okay, we're going to go over to Wes next, N2XJN, who had a question to carry over from last week. You've got it, Wes. Make sure you wait for the beeps. Thank you. Bravo to Rich. Whiskey Bravo 2, Juliet X-ray Mike. What would you like to ask us tonight, Rich? K2RIW.
K2RIW in the group. WB2GXM. Thank you, Dick. I noted last week the number of CW mavens on this net. I am ready to graduate from a straight key to a keyer. And I note there are a number of modes. There's semi-automatic or above. There's fully automatic. Dots on one finger, dashes on the other. And then there's iambic A and iambic B. And my question is any one of these modes better or more popular than the others? K2RW and the group WB2GXM.
I think that's going to heavily depend on who you talk to. Each person's got his own favorite way of doing it, Rich. So there are guys who love a straight key because it's traditional. There are guys who like the bug-like device where you press with the thumb and you get dashes, and you press with your finger and you get dots. There are people who like that. There are people who like the iambic because that's the way they learned. There's a whole lot of extra learning curve required for the iambic, the one where you squeeze it, you get either da-da-da-da-da or da-da-da-da-da, depending on which one you squeeze first. So I'm going to turn it over to the group, to the guys who are CW-oriented. What's your favorite kind of keying device? Is it the iambic, the thug, straight key? Of you guys that are CW mavens, which are your favorites? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW TechNet, we're listening.
WS2N.
Paul, WS2N, we're hearing you over him, so go right ahead. WS2N, now what's your favorite, Paul?
I just want to tell you, I like the iambic.
On the Green Sky map. So you like iambic. Paul, you did use some other keys in your earlier days, and when you finally went through the learning curve of the iambic, I think you're telling us that it was worth spending the extra time learning it because it took a lot less, what's the word I'm looking for now, finger dexterity in order to send pretty high-speed Morse code. Is that approximately what happened, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Thank you.
Right now I'm hearing Paul on the input, so stand by. Okay, I was listening to Paul on the input, and he really likes the iambic here, and with all the settings you've got on a modern day transmitter, you can set it in various ways so that it'll adapt to you, if you know what I mean. So it appears to me, you know, it was Rich, I think, who asked the question. Yeah, that iambic here, it looks like the best way to go. It looks like not as many people are using the old J38 straight key anymore. Some of the traditional people are. But Paul, I can tell Paul's very glad he went over to that transition. WB2JXM, or is it GXM, I think it is. K2RIW in TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Paul, is it iambic A or iambic B, WB2GXM?
I don't know. Back in the 1980s, they just called it an iambic key from MSJ. I can give you the model number, but I'm not even sure if this model number is made. They have, you know, it's the ancestors. Very similar. It's a boxy-looking thing. You still see them in QST. Don't know the difference between A and B. Back to you.
Paul, when it comes back to you after the beeps, tell us what difference there is between iambic A and iambic B. I'd like to know. You've got to pull away to the beeps.
That's what I was saying. I don't know the difference. Back in the 80s when I bought this, it was the iambic key. That was the best thing at the time. So, but I don't even know the difference between the A or B. Back to you, sir.
Okay, thank you, Paul. So, Rich, sounds to me like you're about to get more heavily involved in CW. Out of curiosity, what's your code speed now? And are you in the process of practicing it in order to get higher code speed and be able to do it all more mentally? WB2GXM, K2RIW.
K2RIW, WB2GXM. My code speed was, I passed general and advanced back when you needed to pass the Morse code. I believe that was 20 words per minute. Certainly 13 with a straight key. And my arms got real tired. So I'm ready for that key here. I'm ready to investigate higher speeds and almost, I'd love to get to have CW be a language rather than a string of dits and dots. K2RW, WB2GXM.
Dick, I have the key here. I'll give him the model number and you can take it from there.
Go right ahead, Paul.
I'm thinking it's B, by the way, because that's the last letter on this thing. It's MFJ 422B, so I guess it's a B. By the way, here's the way it sounds if I send CQ on my calls. You know, and then you can go up in speed or down in speed. So, and then it has a volume control on it, and then it's got the outputs that you can plug right into your radio. Back here.
Out of curiosity, Paul, what do you believe your receiving code speed is?
Well, I know it was tested at 20 when the code was at for the test, but I would say that's for contest. You know, if you're listening to calls that coming across 20 or faster, you can get them. But if you're going to get into a queue, so you know you want to get down to 18 or 16 or 15, even if they're giving you a lot of information. But if it's a standard thing, rig, name, QTH, yeah, then you can keep it probably at 18 comfortably. Back to you, Dick.
Paul, let me ask you this crazy question. When you've operated a whole lot of hours in a contest where you've used a whole lot of Morse code, and in some of those cases you're listening for a weak signal in the noise, and somewhere during the contest you take a break, and you listen to the flushing of the toilet in your bathroom, or you listen to the noise of the compressor of your refrigerator, but there's white noise in both cases. Have you ever noticed that you start hearing Morse code inside of that white noise? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's the downside of too much CW. I'll hear it without doing a field day or listening, you know, trying to get a, you know, one DX station any day of the week. You know, if you put a fan on, you could hear it in the fan. You could hear it in the birds as you're walking. Very strange. You know, any kind of continual noise, you could start picking it up. So, it's interesting. One time, it's fun, too, because one time sitting at work, I'm hearing in the distance, I'm having lunch in the car, and in the distance I'm hearing, you know, CW. I don't remember what the guy was sending at the time, but I could hear it. I thought it was, you know, that same type of an effect. I opened a window, two cars down, and this guy was a ham, and he was listening to CW. Back to you, Dick.
KE2EJ, go ahead, Eric. I bet you've heard Morse code in some crazy places.
Oh, yeah. I was actually driving cross-country one year, and I ran into a trucker that had a safety mounted to his steering wheel. That much into it. I don't know if you remember W2SO, Harry Robinson, everybody called him Robbie. He was the chief engineer of the Associated Press at the time. You could sit that man down in front of a typewriter and send stuff that was bordering on 70 words a minute and never miss a thing. 50 words a minute, he didn't need anything. He could just recite it back to you. But anyway, what I wanted to point out is that most modern transmitters actually have in essence, an iambic key. Take a set of bench paddles or something like that. Hook it up. It's built into most modern transceivers today. So, something I wanted to point out. Speak to RWK2, Doug.
Glad to hear it, Eric. And the machine is sounding good tonight. I guess you got my email about there was a slight cutout of the speech, as if the voter was giving a funny response every 2 seconds last week. If you listen to the recording, you can hear it. Well, if you got my email on that subject, KE2EJ, K2IW.
Yeah, I did, but I didn't get a chance to listen to it. So, I'll let you know when I listen to it.
Dick, one other comment about the Kia.
Okay. I got two questions. I got a question for you, Paul. I'm going to turn it back to you, and you're going to tell us about the Kia. Also, I'm going to ask you the question. Was there ever a time when you're on your Chase Lounge in your backyard listening to the birds chirping and you started hearing Morse code? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, and I found out it was K2RIW. So, that's how he got my attention. When he came over one day. Very good, Dick. With the Kia, this MFJ, I guess a lot of the Kias are the same, but this thing seems to last forever. It's from the 1986, and it's still going. But, I do keep a plastic cover on top of it. It's actually like a Tupperware type of cover on top of it, when I'm not using it. Keep any of the dust away. Although I, for many years I didn't have a cover, and it still worked fine. But then I got the bright idea about 10 years ago to leave that cover on top. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to give you guys a little bit of explanation. I visited Paul's house one day, went to his QTH, but didn't tell him I was coming. It was a surprise visit, so to speak. I just happened to be in the area, and I said, "Hey, I'm going to go visit him." And I'm knocking on his front door, and I'm ringing the bell and getting no response. I said to myself, maybe he's not home, but the car was home. And then I tried to go to his backyard, and the backyard is all covered, completely enclosed in a stockade fence. But by looking through the fence, looking through the slats, I could see him on his Chase Lounge in the backyard. So I started whistling his call letters to him. As a guy who's spent an awful lot of his life listening to weak CW in the noise, he heard that immediately, even though I was a long distance away from him. So Morse code can be a lot of fun. Give us a little bit more audio, Rich, when you come back to us. And as you decide which key are you going to buy and you actually try it on your rig, come back and tell us how it worked out. WB2, GXM, K2IW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. Actually, I can't give you any more audio. I'm still on those HTs. But, Paul, thank you very much for your opinion. Copy MFJ422D. Eric, thanks for your opinion. I'm looking forward to this. And if you think about it, guys, you hear Morse code in all these different places. That's how language works. Back to net, K2RIW, WV2GXM.
Pretty true, Jay. I remember what I wanted to say.
It's a minute, so it's pretty good for learning.
Very fine, Paul. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, you were talking about mode A and mode B. From what I remember, or actually what I know, is mode A, which I think actually came later, is when you press both valves together, you get an alternating dot-dash sequence. In mode B, whichever key you hit first, as long as you keep it depressed, it continues to send either a string of dots or dashes. That's the difference.
I thought there was a mode, Eric, where with the iambic here, when you squeeze it, you're going to get da-dar, da-dar, da-dar. And depending on which you squeeze first, if you hit the dash first and then squeeze both, you're going to get da-dar, da-dar, da-dar.
Okay.
And if you hit the dots first with your fingers and then hold it squeezed, the two of them together, you're going to get da-dar, da-dar, da-dar. So you're actually getting da, dit, da, dit, da. In each case, you're getting an alternate dit and da. Which one comes first is a function of which one you press.
Correct.
Okay. Is that mode D, mode A, or both? That whichever one you press first, that's what you get as the lead of the alternate. Over to you, Paul. Eric.
In mode A here, don't forget, an iambic here is really two paddles. So you can squeeze both of them. Depending upon which one you hit first will be the lead character in the character that you're sending. In mode B, when you squeeze one paddle and then squeeze the other one, if you squeeze the dot paddle first, and just for the heck of it, you squeeze the dash paddle, you'll just keep getting a continuous string of dots. Or if you hit the dash paddle first, you'll get a continuous string of dashes. If you squeeze them both at the same time, depending upon the manufacturer, whose logic it is, you either get the dots or the dashes. But you don't get the alternating as you do with mode A. So that's the difference between A and B.
Yeah, he's right with this one anyway, Dick. I get demo.
Yeah, if I hit the dots first and squeeze both, I get a continuous string of dots. If I hit and hold only the dots, can I also get a string of dots, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, in mode B, whatever key you hit first is whatever gets continued. So if you started with dots, you just get dots. And even while you're sending dots, if you hit the dash key, you're still going to get dots. And the same thing the other way around.
It must be mode A then.
Now, what he's describing, I think, is mode B. In mode B, whatever you hit first, you're going to get those string of characters. And it locks out any further reception. You can hit the other key and it's going to ignore it. You is what Eric seems to be saying. I wonder if he was asked that way, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
And he called that what, A or B?
B.
Oh, okay, so then this one is A. Because if I go with dot, and then I squeeze that other one, it'll start alternating. No, so. And if I go with dashes, yeah, the same thing, it'll start alternating. But what's good about it is, for a period, you know, you get